are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Tuesday, January 24th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Roosevelt Fellow, contributor to Dissent magazine, Mike Konzel. On the literal and metaphorical austerity of the Obama years, and what's next. Also on the program, Trump out of TPP, but in with Keystone and Dakota Pipeline. James Comey catches an air kiss and stays at the White House. The second largest insurance company in the country lied about why it pulled out of the Obamacare exchanges. It's an administration in disarray, and Trump is sued by some of the top constitutional law experts in the country. Meanwhile, Democrats seek a huge infrastructure deal. Mike Pompeo nominated and now confirmed as your next crusading CIA chief. 12 Dems voted in favor. We'll tell you who. Donald Trump reinstitutes the global gag rule so that U.S. aid cannot go towards telling women and educating them on things like birth control or abortion or any of their options to have some control over their own body. Trump also freezes federal hiring and issues an extremely confusing Obamacare directive. Meanwhile, Michael Flynn, under and not under suspicion over his relationship with the Russians. Richard Spencer still got punched. And Donald Trump's... and I should say this. State of emergency declared in South Dakota right now to deal with an outbreak of ethics. More on this story in a moment. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, we've got a lot of stuff I got to get to here. I don't like to spend a lot of time talking about myself on this program because I don't have much of a life outside of it. Well. And I don't mean that metaphorically speaking. I mean, I don't mean that literally. I mean, I'm alive. I still function on the hours that I'm not on this program, but I just don't do anything. So I guess metaphorically it's true. However,
there's no substance to your life.
There's no substance. There's not. It's just. I wouldn't even go that far. I think that's even qualifying that statement too much.
It makes it more elevated.
Yeah. However, I do have some news. Here they are. On camera, people can see I'm holding up two prominent statues. Right here in my hand. And last night, I was honored to be awarded the co-rookie, they had to do a co this year, that's okay, co-rookie of the year award for the softball team I play with. So thank you. One of the oldest rookies of the year I think they've ever had. So there's that. And not only did I win co-rookie of the year, but the second one that I won is even more important to me. This is for the most sacrificed flies. most sacrifice flies. And
that is so Sam.
That
the
is
sacrifice fly.
That's right. It
it's
is.
It's sort of like the suicide bombing of baseball.
No, it isn't like the suicide bombing. It's about give. It's about sacrifice.
Well,
actually.
Right, exactly.
And so
that's frankly amazing, given that
it is. It you're
was
right,
like
Kelly.
You're. It seemed like your knees were falling off That's for the right. entire
well,
season.
The yeah, sacrifice lot, we established before
Not
the show.
Not the sacrifice flies,
well,
but
the sacrifice fly one was also voted on.
That was voted on. It was very subjective. There was
congratulations.
A lot of,
no, how did
wasn't
you stuff,
straight.
How did you work the curia for that?
It wasn't straight. I got to tell you, I was also, it turns out, two hits away from batting 500 for the season.
That's good.
Yeah, it is good, Michael. It's really good. But
what kind of a league
grace,
is this?
Well, it's not quite
Christ.
A league. It's not quite a league. But, I mean, there are a couple of guys who are older than me, some in their 60s. But also, the majority of guys, 40s, 30s, 20s. So there you go. Even some high teens in some of those guys.
I'm proud of you, but that's actually sad.
Yeah, it is
pretty
sad.
For them.
It's pretty sad.
I'm shocked.
A couple of things I want to talk about. One is I got just a couple other notes. One is I'm aware of the interview with Tom Brady saying, well, I don't see what the big deal is that I'm friends with Trump. Look, I'm going to tell you what I'll tell you this right now, and I don't want to even bring it up again. I was raised a Patriots fan through some of the worst eras of Patriots football. Victor Kiam, Lisa Olsen. I remember cheering for Sam Bam Cunningham, and Moise Tutupu was even late in the game, and Russ Francis was my favorite player for years. Never mind Plunkett and Grogan. In my home, I am still a Patriots fan. But when myself or my daughter go out, if we ever wear any Patriot regalia at any time, we have a black line that goes through it. We put a black piece of tape across the logo. And when people ask, I say it's because of Trump. So that's what I do. And I don't know. I'm not going to judge anybody else. And that's what I do. Also, we got an IM that said, I was disappointed with the segment Michael did yesterday, which up until that that part of the sentence, I was in no way, if I had just gotten that, I would have been perfectly comfortable with just leaving it there. However, the Twitterer went on to say, did regarding the assault on Richard Spencer. I thought you guys were better than that. Now, I'm really shocked. I'm
why
really
why
shocked.
Did you think we're better than
I'm
that?
Really shocked that people thought that. But yes, I mean, look. I don't know, Michael, if you were advocating violence. I don't advocate violence. That doesn't mean that at times you can't sort of relish it and sort of say like, oh, that seems appropriate. I don't think the guy should be killed.
No,
I don't
no,
think
no.
his
no
family should be in any way harassed.
No, of course not.
But, you know, some of the things that he's written in the past, and I think like, let me put it this way. I'm not shocked that somebody did that. I get the feeling that probably that's just the first time that's happened on camera.
I'm happy to talk about it more in the fun half.
All right, we will do that. We'll do that. You'll be thoroughly scolded. I'm going to scold him. We will get to all of this. There's obviously executive orders that are headed out today. The TPP was never going to pass Congress in this instance anyways, but it is officially dead. Unclear about the TTIP. Unclear about the, I think there's a TSA that's also a big deal, but I imagine, I don't know, it'll be interesting to see if those lesser known deals, which are similar in many respects, go down in flames as well. But we will keep our eye on that. Hey, it's almost Valentine's Day, and here's an idea to make Valentine's Day easy. You can get a couples massage right at home, or you can just send one to your Valentine or, I don't know, family members. You can get it with a private licensed massage therapist from Zeal. Just go to Zeel, Z-E-E-L. It's like eel, but with a Z, .com, or on Zeal's iPhone or Android app. And you can select from top local, licensed, and pre-screened massage therapists. Choose your favorite technique, gender preference, time, and location for your massage. I assume they have like Swedish and deep tissue and shiatsu and I don't know. Zeal will send you one of their 8,000 licensed massage therapists with a massage table, music, supplies to give you a 5-star massage. Scheduling, booking, and payment fast and easy. Even the tip is included. 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and a Zeal massage therapist can be at your door in as little as an hour. It's even been featured in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Vogue, and Good Morning America. You can have the best massage of your life in your own home with Zeal today. And to help you get started, our listeners can get $25, wow, off their first massage by going to Zeal.com or on the Zeal iPhone or Android app using the promo code MAJORITY at checkout. The promo code MAJORITY at checkout. That's Zeal. Z-E-E-L. Like Z and then eel.com. And then make sure to click add promo code at the checkout to use my code MAJORITY. Also, last week, had fried chicken cutlets. And maybe that was 2 weeks ago. We had a chicken, like a sandwich. And there's a specific name for it, but I didn't see what the name of the menu was. But with Lebanese and like pickled tomatoes and with a purple cabbage salad. That's the thing I like about Blue Apron, among other things, is that I eat foods that I wouldn't normally eat. I mean, it's not like I've never had purple cabbage before, but I wouldn't, if I was in the supermarket and I see purple cabbage, I'm like, no way. Kids aren't going to like it, whatever. I'm not even going to try it. They loved it. Apparently they like it because it's crunchy. Oh.
Purple cabbage is great.
It's great. It's and really I think tasty. It's extremely healthy, right?
It is. It's a definitely nutrient-dense food.
Anyways, that's what I had. Yeah, it's totally nutrient-dense. That's what I said to the kids. Kids, eat your nutrient-dense food.
Would you? And record it?
With Blue Apron, the seafood is sourced sustainably. The beef is raised humanely. The regenerative farming practices are used for produce. And because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for the recipe, they are reducing food waste. That is absolutely 100% true. It's just enough for me to have an extra half a meal, which is really more than I should probably have. But what are you going to do? Plus, cooking together builds strong family bonds. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often. Coming up in January, we haven't had any of these yet, and I'm excited now for them. Spicy shrimp and Korean rice cakes with cabbage and fear cake. Pork chops, garlic piccata with scallion rice and spinach. Oh, my God. Mushroom and chipotle pepper enchiladas with lime sour cream. And you can make these, and they're delicious. Check out this week's menu. Get your first 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/majority. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create your incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/majority. I can't stop thinking about those spicy shrimp now. I'm starving. Blue Apron, it's a better way to cook. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Mike Konzel. We also have a lot of great sound. If you're watching on YouTube, we will play this clip that everybody's sharing. It's really sad. And now you understand, like, those calls at the parade. Maybe I should also show Mila's sign that she had. Mila and Nikki went down to Washington. I stayed up here with Saul. We held down the
Did you see John Kerry? Did you see
yes.
the clips, John?
But the video of Melania at the inauguration... Now you understand, like, why you see those signs, Free Melania. It's really sad and also just sort of incredibly disturbing, but sort of from a literary perspective, just sort of, you know, the perfect representation, right? I mean, to a certain extent, there is a quality of, like, the country held hostage by Donald Trump on some level. Just waiting, hoping this lunatic doesn't do something that's really devastatingly bad, as opposed to sort of the slow motion bad stuff. But here on this program, we're going to be focusing a lot on what Congress does, because that's where the game's really being played. And let me just read this one email too, because someone sent me that in that regard. And I think this makes total sense to me. Apparently, Robert Reich put this on his Facebook page. I had breakfast recently with a friend who's a former Republican member of Congress. Here's what he said. That's Reich speaking. Him. Trump is no Republican. He's just a big fat ego. Me, being Robert Reich. Then why didn't you speak out against him during the campaign? Him. You kidding? I was surrounded by Trump voters. I'd have been shot. Me. So what now? What are your former Republican colleagues going to do? Him, smirking. They'll play along for a while. Me, a while? They'll get as much as they want. Tax cuts galore, deregulation, military buildup, slash all those poverty programs, get to work on Social Security and Medicare, and blame him. And he's such a fool, he'll want to take credit for everything. Me, and then what? Him. They like Pence. Me, what do you mean? Pence is their guy. They all think Trump is out of his mind. Me, so what? So the moment Trump does something really dumb, steps over the line, violates the law in a big, stupid, clumsy way, and you know he will, me, they impeach him? You bet. They pull the trigger. I mean,
that's what we've been saying.
And they're just going to wait. I have a feeling that's probably going to be after the midterms, right? They want the midterms, and then, but who knows?
And then if they do poorly, they blame it on him, flip it, impeach him. And Democrats will go along with that impeachment.
I would imagine. All right. Quick break. Come back. Talk to the great Mike Konzel. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program a Roosevelt Institute fellow and contributing editor at Dissent Magazine, Mike Konzel. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hey, thanks for having me back.
All right. So, Mike, you wrote in Dissent, and I want to talk to you just a little bit about what we know about I saw you commenting on health service, health savings accounts on Twitter last night, and obviously, Mnuchin had his confirmation hearing the other day, and we can talk about that. And I think your piece, in some ways, touches on Mnuchin, if not by name, at least when we look back on the Obama years, a guy like Mnuchin was a fairly important figure. Let's just start with the in your piece, the austerity of the Obama years. Let's start with that "keep calm and carry on" slogan. You used it as a as a literary device for the piece. Tell us how.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of write down one last thought about the Obama years so that they're fresh in my head and freshly written as we are leaving them. I think a lot of people are writing these pieces and they're kind of swinging for the fences, like Obama didn't accomplish anything or Obama accomplished everything and, you know, set up a new record. I think that there's a little bit of a deflation with some of the Obama years. And I thought austerity was kind of a key way of understanding like the cultural, the political, and the economics of the period. And one thing that I remember is the kind of keep calm and carry on signs. I don't know, they were found, they were a World War Chew poster from Britain that were like found in an archive or in some boxes in the mid aughts and started to be reprinted in 2008. And they were everywhere in the last eight yeah. years. And that kind of aesthetic, you can see in things like the Hunger Games, just a lot of the art in the sci-fi, things were just kind of like scaled down, like we're being prepared to be invaded or, some crop had failed. And instead it was just that the economy was not running at full steam and a lot of other things were happening.
Yeah, I just remember Jim Scarborough, not Jim Scarborough, Joe Scarborough, just pumping that out. I associate that with him for some reason. That keep calm and carry on. And you give some examples in the piece of like culturally that sense. I mean, what do you think? I mean, give us the order of these things, because we have this crash in 2008. The economy is really devastated, and we have our unemployment rate doubles in the matter of like 12 months, it seemed like. And so it influenced everything, but there was this sort of, I guess, this morality of austerity that comes down the pike.
Right. So yeah. And I think there's a couple of things that happen. And so in a timeline, you want to think of the financial crisis, which in some ways is kind of the least interesting part. I mean, it's unfortunate that we didn't cut bankers' pay or anything like that, or no one went to jail. But when we think about what really happened, that was alongside that was the foreclosure crisis, which I really think really did remake the landscape for a lot of places. States that were the hardest hits obviously had huge foreclosure waves. But even places like the upper Midwest, where you can see polling and some preliminary studies that say places that are still underwater, places where people owe more on their mortgages than the property is worth, which is a direct consequence of the recession and the financial crisis, they were more likely to vote for Trump. And so you see a couple of things, right? So you see the foreclosure wave, which really does remake the landscape so that a lot of places where there is at least some density and some life, even if factories have closed, just hollow out. People aren't building places. People aren't upkeeping places. You have a lot of property, a shadow inventory of homes where just no one's living in them. They're falling apart into disarray. And I think that characterizes a lot of it. And then the second half of that is the geographic inequality, that you have really booming cities that are just out of control expensive. And so you have young people not forming families, not buying places, living in smaller and smaller places. I live in D.C. now, and I was in Brooklyn before. And, micro units are a big thing now, which is less than 400 square feet, which causes like a culture of just having to pare down just because you don't have room for stuff or you can't afford it.
There's also that I noticed over these past 8 years that sort of the rise of I don't know how to say this, increasing your personal productivity, right? Like all of these sort of attempts at, and maybe it's just because I occasionally listen to that Tim Ferriss podcast, but it's all about, I mean, you had this rise of like data journalism, but I think so much of it seems to be about efficiency, right? Like you've got to be as productive as you possibly can because things have become hyper-competitive.
Exactly. So, I mean, one big thing that starts in the Obama years is the iPhones introduced and smartphones are introduced. I actually had this in there. We took it out. But like the iPhone is introduced, I think, 3 months before President then Senator Obama's speech saying he was going to run for president. And I think that's a really interesting thing because smartphones obviously help us not get lost and do a lot of fun things. But they also really ring you to your work and they always make you feel like you have to be on, that there's something you're missing, that they really changed our cultural life in this way that has social consequences, but also has huge economic consequences. Another thing that really happens and starting in this period is the workplaces become a lot more disassembled at contracting work, at call work, part-time or non-traditional work really grows substantially. It grows from about 10 to 15% and kind of represents on net the kind of job growth we've seen in the past 8 years. And that work, a lot of people think, you can kind of get into this elite Silicon Valley and often Democratic elite mindset that this stuff is like fantastic because everyone's an entrepreneur and a small business owner. But for most people, it just means they get fired and hired back as a contractor with less rights, less wages, and a greater sense of they always have to be on and always have to be performing or they're going to lose their jobs.
And you also talk about that other aspect of like tech where there's this sort of movement, particularly like with the Silicon Valley, I don't know, entrepreneurs to be almost like these modern vagabonds.
Yeah, it's a thing that you wouldn't suspect because we think of billionaires, right, and millionaires as having like, you know, mansions and fleets of jets and stuff. But for a certain class of kind of tech stuff, there is this kind of sense of non-permanence as a lifestyle choice. So you see, there's this big thing about the Marie Kondo paring down, like throw away everything that doesn't bring you joy kind of stuff. But there's an aesthetic lifestyle choice to really like have very few possessions. Maybe like only live in Airbnbs and only use an Uber to get around. And you know, the idea that you could kind of get away with a hyper minimalism and not just that kind of like sleek modernism that came with Mad Men, which was obviously the big show of the Obama years, where everything's very modern and it's sleek. It's way beyond that and it became almost a competitive race. And you see it with something, there's a great article, I forget the writer's name, but it's called Airspace, but this kind of aesthetic where, everything's kind of like very industrial, but like scrubbed away of any kind of the grittiness, so like the exposed wood and lighting fixtures of the period. And it's a very classist way because for people who can do this, they're saying they're not worried that they're not going to be able just to buy whatever they need when they need it. So they don't need to save any physical possessions. It's the opposite of the kind of World War II generation that really did want to like can everything and hold everything down.
I mean, so is the story of this era, I mean where's the relationship between, obviously, like you have these people, this whole sort of ethos, I guess, of, you know, of paring down, being, you know, even being monastic in some way, or you know, even if it's like a faux aestheticism, right? You know, because obviously, like if you're a millionaire, it's like all I've got is my rucksack. But you can also then like take a plane anywhere. I'm going to Rio with my rucksack and I'm going to stay in, you know, the most expensive hotel, but I'm not going to steal the toothpaste because of course you can buy your toothpaste wherever you go. I mean, where is the connection between that? Like what is the tissue between that and the fact that in these pockets, largely unseen by the media, frankly, and the rest of America where you're still suffering, this foreclosure crisis, because there's the, like you say, there's the financial crisis, but then there's this sort of rolling problem that is somewhat submerged in our culture, right? It's not like we've had, you know, every now and then, maybe 60 Minutes will do like, there's still a lot of foreclosures, but you don't, it largely disappeared from the narrative of what was going on in this country. And instead there was like this, there was almost like a shadow of it.
Yeah. I mean, there's two things. One is the foreclosure crisis of the administration did not want to pursue it. They had a lot of options. I'm sure you have David Dane on as a guest from time to time. Yes. He just wrote a fantastic book called Chain of Title, which talks a lot about how the Obama administration had, beyond the crisis, beyond the bailouts, years later, back when things were calmer in the financial markets, but, you know, carnage, as our new president would say, in the foreclosure markets, you know, President Obama's administration had a lot of ways to try to push accountability, push reform, push relief into the people who were executing the foreclosures and the banks that were owning them. And they didn't take them. They purposely took like a crumb of a loaf and, you know, didn't try to go much further with it. People were calling out the time, but at the end of the day, if the administration's not going to do it, then of course the media is not going to cover it as much because it's not as much of a priority. The administration's moved on to other things. So the responsibility ultimately has to stop there. Or the buck stops there.
But was part of the reason why we didn't hear about it too was that it was a Democratic administration. I talked to Dayan many, many times over the years about this, but there was really not a lot of other people who were pursuing this, and it was almost as if like the natural constituency to pursue it was silenced by the fact that it was that President Obama was the president. And so, you know, HAMP didn't get the scrutiny that it should have gotten initially, even after the fact when it became clear, like this was just a totally BS program.
Yeah, I mean, the obvious other actors with power who could do stuff are state attorneys generals, and the President Obama put and his administration put a lot of pressure on them, most notably New York AG Eric Schneiderman and others. Camille Harris.
Yeah.
There's just a great story. Dan reported about Camille Harris, then AG of California, now a U.S. Senator, decided not to pursue a criminal investigation of Steve Mnuchin, who's now probably going to be the Treasury Secretary. You know, the person that she should have arrested during the financial crisis, or at least tried to, is now going to be running the Treasury Department and will be in charge of things that we'll put him right up against the AG's priorities that she fought for. The other quick thing, and I discussed a lot in the piece, is there's something, it's a technical term called the output gap. But essentially, we didn't get the recovery we deserved. It was always hanging back a bit. We never really reverted back to where we should have been. And this goes towards the foreclosure crisis a bit. And at some point, President Obama just kind of stopped talking about it. There was originally a period where he said the government needs to step in. There's all this austerity, you know, the state budgets are collapsing. Homeowners aren't investing because their homes are collapsing. Businesses aren't investing because there's no customers. So the government needs to step in. And then they did that in 2009 and it stabilized everything. We didn't go into a Europe decline, but then it didn't really recover it. It was, you know, insufficient. And from there, President Obama, you know, he started talking about how we need a grand bargain in 2010 and 11 or 2011.
He made his famous austerity pivot in 2010, essentially.
Yeah, and that's been written out in a lot of these history books. And ultimately, nothing came of it because the Republicans were so pigheaded about wanting everything. Thank God. But, you know, that was the story about why the economy never recovered. And then that fell through. And then it just kind of was a void. I mean, you know, the numbers were fine. The numbers were good even sometimes and with job creation. But they were never enough to catch up. And it's really sad because the numbers ended up getting us back to where we were in 2007. But you and many of your listeners remember that 2007 sucked for working people. And it's why President Obama and the Democrats were elected, to fix the Bush economy. So, you know, it was ultimately said that he never really had a message or a priority around it. And that's parallel to the way the foreclosure crisis just disappeared as a political priority.
And we should say, and maybe it would be helpful if you explained just briefly what the output gap is. But in addition, we can get back to where we were in 2007, but we just lost 10 years. Right. Of what is supposed to happen over those 10 years, all the compounding interest or aggregation of your work life, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. And the upper gap is, it's how much we could be making as an economy. So how much output we could make, how many people could be employed, how much wages could be up, how much investment in research and productivity could be going up versus what's actually happening. And so, you know, what we could have, you know, it wasn't like we were bombed in 2009 and that's why we couldn't, why so many people were unemployed. People were unemployed because people weren't buying stuff. And that's a kind of classic Keynesian demand side recession. And we put a floor under it. And if you actually go back to 2009, you read people like Larry Summers at the NEC and elsewhere, they were very conscious of the idea that they were just putting a floor in against the worst case outcome because they thought everything would get better quickly, that the output gap would go away, would revert back quickly. But we never did. It just kind of hung there like this kind of like parallel universe where everyone's a little bit poorer, more unemployed, has the more precarious jobs, corporate profits are a little bit more higher. than they would have been otherwise. And that really, I think, does hang on our society and made us more vulnerable to demagogues, which was ultimately our downfall in 2016. And it put us in this kind of zero-sum mindset, which amplifies the politics of the Tea Party. You know, they're taking your stuff and giving it to these other people, which you're worried about when things aren't as plentiful as they'd be other, when there's this landscape of austerity. So I think it really did impact everything across the board.
I feel like that that dynamic where the elites, the ostensibly, left of center, ostensibly left of center elites were interested in putting a floor down. That metaphor, I feel like, has animated all sorts of reactions on the left and the right, right? I mean, that's like, that to me is, we saw Clinton in some ways still trying to campaign with that dynamic, right? Where you know, early in the campaign, it was, well, I'm for expanding Social Security, but for the people who are suffering the most. And even when she was dragged along with the debt-free college, or just the idea of debt-free college as opposed to free college, right? Or debt-free college that is free college that is means-tested. It seems to have permeated all of that. And I think like a lot of the pushback, both on the right and the left, is a function of that. Like, you guys just wanted to save things for yourself, not for everybody else, right? I mean, isn't that when Larry Summers comes out and says, like, we should put a floor on this, that's what he's basically saying. It's like, as Larry Summers, I think he's like looking around going like, you know, us guys, we have the ability to come back from this on our own as long as it doesn't turn into a total, total disaster. So we just need the foundation. But other people, the foundation is meaningless to them.
Yeah, and you're seeing it with a lot of the things about how elites have congratulated themselves about their handling of the financial crisis in the aftermath. And I mean, it is true, we didn't have a Great Depression. You would know if we had a Great Depression, it'd be a lot worse. But what we did have was not enough. And in particularly, and you see with a lot of this Democratic agenda, is it's really poorly suited for helping working class people right at the margins, right? So you can say, you know, we expanded Medicaid. So we have this kind of like single payer-ish thing for poor people, which is really great. And people like Medicaid. And then we have a bronze plan for working class people who barely have enough money to get by. So now you're going to get a bronze plan, but it's complicated. And there's you get subsidies, but how do the subsidies work? And you have to gauge your income. Like you set up a tension that does not need to exist, right? Debt-free college is perfect, right? Why are you setting up a tension between someone who makes maybe like a middle-class couple that's going to have a college bill now and a working-class family that might have a smaller one? Like, they should be solidaristic allies in making sure people can get their kids can get educated in good schools. Instead, you've created a class tension where one does not need to exist. You saw a lot of reporting coming out after the election about people who are relatively poor, who are in the Obamacare exchanges. Sarah Cliff at Vox did some reporting from Kentucky, who were really angry and jealous of people who could get on Medicaid, right? That's a tension that's really tough. And this kind of floor way of approaching social insurance and having good things for our citizens creates a tension that's just a nightmare to deal with politically.
What do you think is behind that? Like, my sense is it's less about, I mean, it seems to have the impact of you know, sort of creating, throwing, I don't know, a bomb in the middle of some type of clash consciousness, right? I mean, to, provide another for certain groups of people to hate and whatnot. But I can't help but think that, like, that the architects of this just don't get it on some level, right? Like, I mean, you tell me. You are far more familiar with the way that these people devise these plans. Like, I think it's just sort of like a complete obliviousness or some other sort of puritanical notion of, like, we've all got a bootstrap and, you know, we can make exceptions for some people, not to mention We're still going to take our home mortgage deduction. That's something completely different. But you know, why is there that almost relentless sense of creating programs in that fashion that are not universal?
I think there's two big things that factor into it. One is the general idea that the American economy just basically works for everyone except the very poor. That you can kind of have a really strict line that says, okay, basically everyone who has a job full time is doing fine and it'll be okay, except the very poor. And we just need to like have very specific programs for them to make sure they have the opportunity to become working class, which is not how Social Security is put together, right? That's not, it's a way of dividing up that in many ways, that kind of pity and charity view of the liberal welfare state really dehumanizes people and also just makes it hard to actually create a class consciousness around these things or have programs that are defended widespread. A second is, I think, and this is definitely definitive of the Bill Clinton years, is a presumption that markets are always going to be the best way. And so the more you can make someone have to open an envelope with a bill in it, the more you can make someone have to like look at their balance sheet and just figure out where they're going to put all their money and all these savings programs or whatnot, the more you can individualize people's relationship with programs makes it better because markets are magic. Even though we know markets don't really work for social insurance or making sure elderly people have food and, you know, and health insurance, right? So I think that between those two things, it's basically a recipe for alienating working class people of all races and genders, because it basically says, unless you can prove how poor you are itself, a kind of dehumanizing thing, we're not going to care too much about you. And to the extent we do, we're going to put you in front of a predatory profit-making institution and wish you luck at dealing with them.
So much of it, I think, it has to do with that sense of like of this notion of individuals and their relationship to society. I mean, I feel like I keep in the back of my mind, you know, thinking about the moralizing that Obama would do about individuals, with particularly when addressing the black community, about, you know, be your brother's keeper type of thing, and talking about the specific responsibilities of individuals as opposed to talking about things in a systemic way. I guess in some way it also sort of validates, like, if I really perceive the individual to have this power in society, then wherever I am, whatever station I'm at, is a function of me as opposed to somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. When you're talking about the things we're talking about, like, you know, everyone's going to be too old to work someday. You know, they need insurance. You can't, and you know, you can say you should save enough for yourself, but if you make a bad investment or you just never made that much money, it's hard to do, right? I feel like that individualistic stuff really breaks down in the things we're talking about. Like, if you happen to have lived in a city where the factory left for China because China kept its currency too low for 10 years, that's not, you can be as diligent and bootstrapped as you want, you're still screwed. So especially at this moment, especially in the moment of the past 8 years where the macro economy really became a real thing again, when the idea that the economy is a force beyond any individual's control, that your economic fate is not just a matter of how hard you work or how good you did in school, but whether or not you graduated into a recession or, you know, whether or not you lived in a place or an industry that was wiped out by all this stuff. The fact that those arguments never really moved to that dimension in a strong enough way, I think, was a real missed opportunity.
And so if that's...
Ironically, Trump's the only one who talked in that way. And he also married it to like white nationalism, which is disturbing. But like, I felt like he and Bernie Sanders were like on the... They got what was going on in that way.
Well, I mean, that's when Trump gets up there and talks about the American carnage, right? I mean, I think the majority of the country still is like, what? What are you talking about? But there are some people out there who I think perceive it in that manner.
Absolutely, yeah. Small towns that have serious opioid addictions and have lost manufacturing or lost whatever core industry kept them going, absolutely don't view, the fact that they can. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
And but the interesting is, because you had talked about in the piece about how Obama's presidency was a gamble on two theories of change. One, that Obama could overcome bitter partisanship, and two, that he could stitch together this coalition that would empower Democrats. One certainly didn't happen, and two seemed far too much a function of Obama, the person, rather than any type of set of issues and, I guess, policy responses. So when we see, if your theory is correct, okay, that we have this sort of denial that had been ongoing in the country that was, and policies that basically were prescribing people to just sort of as an individual, which is going to give the individual an opportunity to go forward here. If you really, really can't do it, we'll take care of you. But what we're going to promise is everybody an opportunity. We're just not going to let the floor fall out. What we're seeing now that, basically President Paul Ryan is going to be instituted with the help of his carnival barker is going to be even more of that, right? I mean, we're going to go, when we talk about health savings accounts and, privatizing Social Security in some fashion, block granting Medicaid, that's what it's all going to end up looking like, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think Paul Ryan has a very Randian vision that private charity could take care of all of social insurance needs, where private charity only works as well as it does because it's built on top of Medicaid and food stamps and other things that provide income support for needy people in communities. The big worry I have is, will Trumpism work? You could imagine that Donald Trump has you could imagine he puts forward an agenda that could, deliver some gains for working class people, but also build a police state, or have working gains only for white people and build a police state and Muslim registry bases and really screw up the political coalitions towards a right-wing direction. Now, I think Trump is too incompetent and Ryan and McConnell are too powerful, especially relative to him, to kind of pull off anything. So
what would that look like? What would that look like? I mean, because, this is one of the things that I've been talking over and over again about is, do you focus on defeating the right wing agenda by cleaving Trump from Ryan and McConnell? Or does that open up the potential of some type of authoritarianism coming in because you've empowered the lunatic? But what would policy prescriptions by Trump? I mean, I guess if Trump went along with, let's say, this Democratic proposal for infrastructure where you're actually sort of financing this and not privatizing it, right? Directly hiring the federal government directly hiring 10 million people.
I think if Trump wanted a nationalistic populism that could work, he would have to have a serious infrastructure bill. He doesn't. They're basically just tax credits for builders. He would need to do immigration in a way that really goes after the employers. They're not going to do that. They love employers. He would need to take a couple industry types of things and throw them under the bus. He'd have to really pass Glass-Steagall. He's not going to do that. Goldman Sachs runs the administration. He would, you could imagine something where he's like, let's get rid of the exchanges, but have a Medicare buy-in for people over 50, which is what the Democrats didn't do. But they can't do that because Paul Ryan wants to privatize Medicare. So I think he's boxed in so many different ways. Would those things work for enough people to get 51% of the votes, or 51% of the electoral college more appropriately? Yeah, I think they might, but I don't think he's going to do it. And I'm glad because I think that policy agenda that is just actively not inclusive and not really forward-looking to where we're at, I think is bad for us in the long term.
So in some respects, Donald Trump could basically institute a bunch of, I mean, in a world where he actually had that latitude and the capacity to contemplate it, I think, he could pass, you know, half of Bernie Sanders' proposals. And then that would put him in a unique position. But that's also like, you know, me saying if I had wings, I would have flown to you and we would have done this interview in person.
And I want to clarify what you just said. The things I brought up, I don't think are bad ideas. I think we really do need a massive infrastructure bill. I think Trump marrying progressive priorities like the Sanders agenda with Muslim databases and this war on crime kind of like scary police stuff. I think that would be incredibly dangerous and scary. But for better or worse, I don't think he's going to be able to pull that off.
Indeed. So let me ask you this. From a political standpoint, what happens? What happens if the Democrats right now are talking about proposing this massive infrastructure bill, right, where there's tremendous amount of spending? What if they show up at the White House and Trump says, yeah, I like this one better than the one that Ryan brought me. Let's do this one. I mean, what do we do? Like, do you start then? I mean, because I think they're, you know, the reason why the Democrats are doing this bill is because they think it's the right thing to do. And they also happen to think that Trump's not going to do it. And it's going to bring at least some clarity as to what this argument is about. But what if, you know, Bannon says to Trump, like, oh, yeah, no, do that one. And I mean, what do we, you know, do we, I mean, don't we then support that?
So, yeah, right. Like we're trying to call a bluff, but what if the bluff's actually called? I don't know. I'm to be honest with you. I don't quite know how that plays out, in part because I just genuinely don't think he's going to do it.
No, I agree. But it's an important contingency to have, I think, at one point, right? I mean,
and it's also important. The most important person right now in all this is Mitch McConnell, right? He will decide what ultimately is passed bill wise. The House will basically pass anything that's reactionary. And I don't even know if the House would actually do this infrastructure bill either, but Mitch McConnell in particular does not seem like he wants to have a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. The big thing I think would be like, we propose $1 trillion and Trump says, okay, how about $300 billion? Or he just proposes Hillary's, which was $200 billion. And then I think we have to say, no, we don't want this. We want the full deal. Or like, this is just, you know, a progressive, this is, you know, like infrastructure washing, your pro-corporate agenda that's going to really weaken workers at the expense of bosses. I think that's the more practical thing, is if he comes back and says, I'll offer you 20%. And we know from the Obama era that Democrats love to take just a slice of bread instead of trying to go for the loaf. Mm. And that's when I think we have to call BS on it.
Right. Right. Because, that's pretty clear at this point. I mean, I think it's got to be an all or nothing situation. I think it's just going to be curious. It's going to be interesting. It may not be the infrastructure, but there's going to be maybe one thing, I think, at one point where Trump just says, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And that's it. And then we're going to be like, okay. It's going to be interesting. But Mike Consul, the piece is The Austerity of the Obama Years, an important look back on those years. I mean, we haven't seen, it's been interesting. That's why I really enjoyed reading your piece, is because there was not the amount of retrospection about Obama's years as one would have anticipated 5 months ago. And I think partly because people are just sort of in this state of shock. And, you know, where I think we're about 4 months away from President Obama, people trying to, I don't know, climb, put his visions on Mount Rushmore just on their own, just out of longing and sentiment from after Trump. But thanks so much for your time, Mike. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks. I mean, it's going to be, right? I mean, wouldn't you have anticipated, like, all of these thought pieces about like the Obama years. What did they mean? And now it's all just like, yeah, we don't. Let's
now
just,
it's all just like, hey, look at him hold the door for Michelle. What a decent human right. being compared to this grotesque sociopath.
Well, I feel
I
like
know it, literally. I feel it's like not it's, even a joke. I it's mean, the, that's, it's and the, I think a lot of people are having that reaction.
It's the difference of like getting off the cruise ship and looking back at the times you had on the shuffle deck board and on the Lido deck and this and that versus having to bail the cruise ship because it's hit an iceberg and you're in the rowing boat. You're not looking back at all the fun times. You're just shivering in the ice cold water.
I guess I could try to extend the metaphor. You're not complaining about the food.
Right.
You're not dissecting the specifics of the floor plan.
Exactly.
You're like, being on that ship was really nice, right. relatively speaking, rowing to save our lives in right. freezing temperatures. Yeah.
Strange time that we're living in, folks. And when we come back, we've got all sorts of sound and let me just explain to people, because we have a lot of new listeners, I think, about what goes on around here. We do a free 45-minute daily show, which ends up usually being a little bit longer than that. And then what supports that show, to a certain extent, advertising, not nearly totally, but then what we do is we do an extended show that if you want to listen as a podcast, got to be a member. And it's literally just pennies a day. I mean, 30 pennies probably a day, but there's no law against having 30 pennies yet. And you can support this program. And so when you support this program, we give you the benefit of the extra content, funnier, livelier, a little bit more news of the daisier.
At some point, we'll have to explain who Right Wing Mandela is for these new people.
Yeah, there's all sorts of things you can come in. It'll be completely difficult for you to understand what's going on because I'm doing a Trump impression as Bane. And Michael's doing a derivation of the right-wing Mandela that is now who's spending time with Joey No Socks. I mean, it's all very confusing, but mildly amusing. And also, I should tell you, the member show is commercial-free. We don't cut out little garbage like this, but we could, I guess, I mean, if there was a big enough push. So become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. But if you don't, and if you don't, as always, if you don't have the finances to become a member, just email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Have a little patience with us getting to your email, and we will hook you up. Also, if you are a freebier, head over to iTunes and give us a review. It makes a big difference. It gets us up in the ratings. I don't know how. You know, and I think that's helpful. I think you can go to majority.fm/review, and it'll take you right to the iTunes preview, and you can just click on it and then give us a review in iTunes. And also, you know, we're going to be having a February vacation coming up soon. You got to check the DOE calendar to find out when exactly. But maybe we'll play Two Dope Boys. And so the people get a little taste of what that bad boy is all about.
It's moving along, getting great iTunes reviews. Thank you, everybody.
Which is the show that Michael co-hosts with his buddy Phil. And then like a roving band of other people.
A roving band?
Well, rotating.
Okay.
I mean, we don't know what they do when they're like, not on your show. For all right. we know, they could be
they're
roving.
Somali pirates. They're a roving band.
Could be.
That would actually be great. What would like a Somali pirate perspective on the Sprint title deal? It's like, there okay, you go. I am the captain now.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.